More than a decade ago, GM embarked on a small car program. Sitting here today, I cannot tell you why it took so long for a safety defect to be announced for this program, but I can tell you we will find out. This is an extraordinary situation. It involves vehicles we no longer make, but it came to light on my watch, so I'm responsible for resolving it.
GM CEO Mary Barra testifying right now at a House Subcommittee hearing. It's called the GM Ignition Switch Recall. Why did it take so long? The hearing is part of an investigation into why it took more than 10 years for GM and the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, or NHTSA, to recall 2.6 million cars with faulty ignition switches. The cars could suddenly turn off while driving if the ignition was bumped or jostled. And once the engine turned off, power steering and brakes would fail, airbags would not deploy. Also, separately, GM announced yesterday that it's recalling another 1.5 million cars for a power steering defect. So let's talk about all of this now with Daniel Howes. He's a business columnist with the Detroit News, and he's covered the auto industry for many years. He's listening in on the hearings. And welcome to Press Play and taking out this moment to talk with us.
Thanks for having me.
Tell us what's happened so far in the hearing.
Well, we've had some statements from various members of the committee, and now they're into question. And Mary Barra has made her statement, her opening statement, in which she said that they had retained Kenneth Feinberg, who had done some of the victim funds for 9/11 and the Boston Marathon and the BP oil spill. And I think that's a signal that they're looking at creating a victims fund. She didn't say they're going to do it, but I think that they pretty much are telegraphing that they're going to do it. And she's now going through questioning, and different members of Congress are taking different tacks, that's to be sure. Some are a little more aggressive, others are more a little more ginger in trying to understand kind of how the process worked and things like that.
Right. Now, she worked at GM during that time period, but she was not, obviously, CEO. So
right.
She didn't have a say whether or not there would be a recall.
Well, that's right. And Mary is what we call around here a GM lifer, and second generation GM employee, has worked in a lot of different jobs. But a decade ago, she was in a different area of the company. But as she pointed out in the, and I think you talked about it at the top of with your clip, you know, it's happening on her watch, and she's got to deal with it.
Right, and she's taking an apologetic approach. She has apologized.
And numerous times.
Yeah, numerous times. But is that unusual for a CEO to apologize like this?
I think it's a little out of character for this industry and this company. Although, but I think it's more in character for what people expect in this day and age, frankly.
Right.
I think they're trying very hard to distance themselves from the way in which the company used to behave in situations like this. It typically would be very legalistic and very defensive. But by their own admission and their own data that they are releasing, I mean, they've known about this problem for a very long time. I'm struck, as I'm thinking about a column for tomorrow, I'm struck by 9 words that I think are going to come back to haunt them. None of the solutions represents an acceptable business case.
Hmm.
That's been being quoted to them by the committee, and I think that's going to be something that they're going to have. It's going to be ringing in their ears for a long time.
Because it turns out that it would have been very, very inexpensive to fix this problem.
Yes, exactly, and
like less than $1 per.
Right, and so the question really is, and I wrote about this recently. The question is, you know, what was going on inside the company at the time? And this was a company that was under. This is before the bankruptcy, obviously, but it was already under financial siege. And there was an awful lot of things going on. There was a lot of turmoil. This car program, the Cobalt, and the vehicles that were part of it, was pretty much snakebit from the start. It was not well received critically. It was kind of a disaster, frankly. And this is just a very fitting kind of coda to the whole thing.
Right. And then they had also received a lot of warranty complaints and had not acted on them.
No, they had acted on them, but they had not put two and two together, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, when you get warranties, you'd make the repairs, but you don't necessarily say, well, you know, do we have a problem here? And I think that's really the issue that everybody's trying to get at. And one of it is, I think this is a very evocative of one of the when the wraps on General Motors, and frankly, to some extent, the industry. We saw it in the Toyota recall 4 years ago, is that you have in these companies silos, and oftentimes they do not communicate well with each other unless there are specific ways in which they communicate. And one of the things that Mary Barra is talking about is how she's trying to break that down already, and some of the things that she's doing, and some of the fixes she's already made, because I think they recognize that there's a lack of communication, that there's an expectation that these problems come up through the product development silo of the company, when in fact they really come up through the safety and legal channels, and they don't necessarily talk to each other, believe it or not. And they're trying to fix that.
Okay, so later on, the acting administrator of the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, it's David Friedman, is scheduled to testify, and he's planning to not take responsibility, not apologize for, and saying basically it's, from what I understand, this was all GM's fault, was it?
Well, yes, I think they've made it very clear. Both the head of NHTSA and the Secretary of Transportation have basically made it clear that they were going to blame General Motors for this. And probably at the end of the day, you could say, yeah, but they do have to coordinate with each other, and they have to recognize what the problems are. I find it a little disingenuous to say, well, if we knew more, we would have been tougher, and if they would have told us more, we would have been tougher. I suspect that there's some complicity in both sides here, probably a little more shaded to General Motors, but nevertheless, I think the regulators probably bear some culpability here.
And they're going to say, well, there's not enough funding, and we need more funding to conduct more thorough investigations.
I suppose, you know, whatever.
So, yeah.
Look, wherever you sit on about General Motors, and there's also the whole bailout issue and everything else attendant to this, but this is a serious problem, and you know, here in a town where we have a lot of homers and people that want to spring to the defense of the company or get critical of those of us that write about some of these things and point out the problems, I think any fair-minded person would look at this and say this is a real problem, and they've got to figure out a way to deal with it and move forward, and I don't think they're going to be able to hide behind their bankruptcy immunity shield either.
Well, and this is where they say, oh, well, because we've emerged out of bankruptcy, we're not liable for anything prior to 2009. Mm-hmm. That's not going to wash?
I don't think it will. You know, they can make that argument, but as some bankruptcy attorneys, because this is Bankruptcy Central here in Southeast Michigan, pointed out to me, you know, you don't have a shield, immunity shield, if you never disclosed it. So if they didn't disclose that this was a problem as part of their disclosures, then they may not have the shield. But I think the PR here, remember, this is a company that sells to it's a customer facing company. Now you can talk about how their brands are not General Motors; their brands are Chevy and Cadillac and Buick and GMC. But at the end of the day, most people know the connection. And, you know, they have to do a cost-benefit analysis here. And if they try to really be legalistic about this, particularly when they've been bailed out by the American taxpayer, they're sitting on something north of $35 billion in cash, they're not going to – I think it's going to be very hard for them to make the argument, you know, we're shielded from this stuff and we're not responsible.
All right. Daniel Howes, business columnist with the Detroit News. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Well, every year on this date, April 1st, those crazy kids at Google headquarters announce a fake product. Last year, it was Google Nose.
Photo, auditory, olfactory, sensory convergence is a phenomenon that's been promised in science fiction for decades.
We're excited to announce Google Nose Beta, our flagship olfactory knowledge feature enabling users to search for smells.
Our mobile aroma indexing program has been able to amass a 15 million centibyte database of smells from around the world.
Google already had a reputation for its April Fool's Day jokes back in 2004, 10 years ago, which is why everyone thought it was a prank when they released a new product called Gmail. This new email service offered almost unlimited storage space by 2004 standards, one whole gigabyte, and the company said it would change the way we think of email forever. It was no joke, as we know now. A decade later, Google now offers 15 gigs of space and, at last count, has 425 million active users. And according to our guest, it didn't just change the way we think of email. It actually launched the modern web as we know it. Harry McCracken is editor-at-large of Time Magazine. Hi, Harry.
Hey there.
Well, let's go back 10 years ago. Google already had this reputation for pulling jokes. What made Gmail seem like a joke, though? Was it all that storage space?
That was part of it, because 1 gigabyte was 500 times what Hotmail, which was the most popular service at the time, offered. So it seemed sort of implausible based on that. But also, I think people forget today that at the time, back then, Google was famous for only doing search. They really hadn't branched out much. And even the notion of Google offering email in any form sounded a little suspicious to a lot of people, at least at first.
Right. And this was very different because was this the first cloud storage?
It wasn't the first one. There were a bunch of other email services at the time, but they offered just a very few megabytes of space. So the moment your friend sent you even a file attachment, you started to have to desperately delete stuff. And Gmail introduced the notion that you might be able to store all of your email in the cloud. And at that time, really, almost everything that was important to people, they stored on their local computer. So this was before people stored photographs on online services very much. It was before they stored things like word processing documents. And I think the fact that Gmail said that your most important stuff should be in the cloud, not on your computer, was a new idea at the time.
It was controversial, though, even back then, because it came out that it scanned your email messages for words for advertising.
That's right. At the time, people did not give a lot of thought to sort of online privacy issues relating to advertising. And the reason that Google was able to offer so much space for free was it looked, you know, an automated system looked at your email and found keywords and displayed little text ads. And that shocked a lot of people at the time. There were 31 privacy groups who sent a letter to Google saying that it should stop doing this immediately. And you know, another thing about Gmail, which is easy to forget, was when it launched, it was almost impossible to get on. They let 1,000 people in at first. And so a lot of people were very concerned about this advertising, not based on having seen it, but having heard about it. And things did settle down, but they tended to settle down once more people got into Gmail and saw that, if you mentioned your own health problems, you were not going to see ads based on that, and the ads were pretty innocuous.
Hmm. So people are still working on new email products that would knock Gmail off its perch. Why is it still so popular? Why hasn't there been anything to replace it along the same lines?
Well, I think, generally speaking, Google has done a good job of preserving the things that were good about Gmail. The look and feel are still very similar, but adding more capabilities. Most people get far more email in 2014 than they did in 2004, and today's Gmail has a bunch more features that help automate the process of seeing the stuff that you probably care about and having the stuff that is not as important not clutter up your inbox.
Yeah, I don't know, but the interface, the web interface at least, is not that visually appealing.
No, I don't think that Gmail was ever popular because it was beautiful. It was popular because it was functional. And so on some level, I admire the fact that it sort of still has a little bit of a 2004 look to it. And there are other email services such as Yahoo Mail that work more on aesthetics, but aesthetics alone are not what you want in email. You want something that's practical.
Well, you could have both. It's possible.
Yeah, and then Gmail does look a little bit better than it did back then. Again, it's sort of that the focus is on let me see the stuff that's important to me and hide the stuff that doesn't matter so much.
So, but I've heard a lot of people saying, look, you know, these privacy issues, they're more important to me now, and there are other services. You could use the service that comes with your Apple, with your Mac. And so are people a little more dissatisfied, or is it just as popular as ever?
Certainly, privacy in general is more in people's minds than ever. And there are reasons to think about the stuff you do in an email service that's stored in the cloud. And Microsoft has Outlook.com, and they really tried to make hay about the way Google's advertising works, and it doesn't seem to have helped them that much. You know, I think when all is said and done, for most people, the fact that Google's advertising is done in an automated fashion, it does not involve people looking at your emails, and Google has done a good job of not showing ads that you might find to be disturbing, means it's a fair deal overall. But you're right. The great thing about email is there are a bunch of good options, and if what Google is doing bothers you, Outlook.com is available and is quite good.
Harry McCracken, editor-at-large of Time magazine, thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, we talk Colbert and Twitter and series finales, why TV loves killing off major characters, with our regular TV expert, Michael Schneider. That's next on Press Play.
Take KCRW with you on one of our smartphone apps, available for the iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry. You can stream KCRW live, listen to podcasts, and all our news and music streams. Learn more and download at kcrw.com/apps.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Tuesday means TV here at Press Play. And gosh, we have a lot to talk about today. Michael Schneider is our TV guy. He's the Los Angeles Bureau Chief for TV Guide and host of KCRW's The Spinoff. Hi, Michael.
Hey, Madeline.
Okay. First things first, we're going to talk about How I Met Your Mother, which delivered on its promise, its eponymous promise, last night in its finale. And it's been on the air for, what, 9 years?
9 years, over 200 episodes. And the finale did very well. It was actually the highest rated episode of How I Met Your Mother in the show's entire history. So people definitely wanted to tune in to see finally how the lead character, played by Josh Radnor, met the mother.
Met the mother. So that was the premise of this 9-year odyssey, right? That he was basically telling his kids a shaggy dog story that he never got to the ending until last night. And let's just hear a little clip. And again, I'm going to just say it loud and clear. This is a spoiler alert for people who haven't seen it and want to tune in.
Let's look at the facts here. You made a sit down and listen to the story about how you met Mom. Yet Mom is hardly in the story. No. This is a story about how you're totally in love with Aunt Robin. And you're thinking about asking her out, and you want to know if we're okay with it.
I can't believe this. I kept this story short and to the point, and you guys still missed it.
Okay, so...
That was a spoilery clip.
That was a spoilery clip. Sorry, everyone, if you didn't have a chance to turn the radio down and you want to watch it. But anyway, you do have another opportunity now because we're going to keep talking about it. Tell us, did you like the ending where we find out who the mother was?
I got to say, the majority of the internet, which is, of course, where everyone sort of discusses TV these days, did not like it. It's a very controversial ending in that, again, spoiler alert, the entire odyssey was about how this lead character meets the mother. But ultimately, the mother leaves the picture rather quickly.
Do you think fans are ever totally pleased with a finale with an ender?
It's very rare. A lot of people love the Breaking Bad finale, but there were even critics on that one that, people argued that it was too tidy. It sort of cleaned up a little too nicely. On the flip side, when people try to do different things, like the end of The Sopranos, when it faded to black, that upset a lot of viewers. Finales are hard, and you could probably count on one hand the finales that people feel actually worked. Newhart being probably the pinnacle, the best example of an ending that people really adored.
What happened there?
That was the one where Suzanne Plachette and Bob Newhart woke up, and it turns out the entire series was nothing but a dream that Bob from the Bob Newhart show was having.
Another finale this week that was a season 4 finale, it was not a series finale, was The Walking Dead. And it seems like this show can really do no wrong. 15.7 million people tuned in for the finale for scenes like this one.
Rick, what do you want?
Where are our people?
You didn't answer the question.
Okay, this is incredibly popular. 15.7 million people on cable. Great for cable, right?
Oh, it's amazing for television. Forget just cable. That's huge. And the number in the demo, adults 18 to 49, which is what advertisers still care about, it's by far the most watched show on television.
And so do you think they can keep it up?
I think so. I mean, the show is hitting on all cylinders right now. It's such a smash that the only difficult thing is we're going to have to wait now until October to see the resolution of the big cliffhanger at the end of that episode. And AMC is going to have to wait another several months until October to get those kind of ratings again.
Mm-hmm. And AMC, does it have anything else going on?
Well, the Mad Men, the final season of Mad Men is about to come back in April. And so they've split that up into two halves of a season, actually. So the first half, first seven episodes, will air this year. And then you're going to have to wait until next April for the final seven episodes. They also have several new shows that are coming on. They have a Revolutionary War era show about spies during that time called Turn, which is about also to launch. And then they have another period show called Halt and Catch Fire, which takes place in the early days of the computer revolution, starring Lee Pace, and that's going to show up later this year as well.
Let's talk about premieres now. Okay, so most people know that's the theme music from Game of Thrones. Season 4 premieres on Sunday, and this show has become rather famous, or maybe infamous, for killing off beloved characters with really no remorse. Is that now a theme? Because we're seeing it in The Good Wife. We're seeing it, as we said, in The Walking Dead. Do viewers, are they okay with that?
Yeah, I think viewers now are sort of used to it. You could probably go back to The Sopranos really, really started this trend. And then Lost also picked up on it in that you had major characters that you thought would last the length of the series, killed off, sometimes early in its run. Game of Thrones, of course, took it to a whole new level when at the end of season one, again, since we're talking spoiler alerts, if you haven't watched season one yet, when the character played by Sean Bean is killed at the end of the season, that was a main character. That was the main character on the show. And that sort of sent a message to the world, to viewers, that we're not playing around here. The things like this will happen. And sure enough, it's happened many times since then. And now it's commonplace on The Walking Dead. And of course, most recently, we saw on Scandal and also on The Good Wife.
And so what is the reaction? Do fans say, OK, well, we'll go with it because now we're kind of used to this dramatic twist?
To some degree. And you know, of course, like anything, now it's in danger of being overused. Yeah. And at some point, viewers are now sort of used to it. Oh, okay, here comes another main character that is going to be killed off. I get it. It's not quite as shocking as maybe it was a couple years ago. But nonetheless, it also allows shows to maybe hire actors who don't want to be tied down for 7 years or however long most contracts now last. If you want to get a big actor who only wants to stick around for a year or two, that's one way to do it, is to kill them off after a year or two. And it also allows actors who want to move on and who are ready to move on to go out with a bag.
All right. Speaking of killing off characters, there was a movement, a brief movement, to kill off Stephen Colbert, the fictional Stephen Colbert. The show posted a racially offensive joke on Twitter that some people said went too far. And then there was a whole movement on Twitter, hashtag cancel Colbert here. And he couldn't respond because his show was dark on Friday. So here is his reaction to the whole thing on last night's show.
And folks, internet equality is more important than ever, as I learned this weekend when the interwebs tried to swallow me whole. But I am proud to say that I got lodged in its throat and it hacked me back up like a hastily chewed chicken wing. This is Who's Attacking Me Now?
Okay, so it was really funny. And, right. You know, he handled it in his usual Colbertian way. Is this now done?
I think so. I think a lot of people came to his defense. First off, because it was a tweet that wasn't tweeted by him or his producers or his company, his production team. It was tweeted out by the marketing staff at Comedy Central and completely taken out of context. And on paper, it is an offensive comment, but it's satire. It's supposed to be sort of offensive on that level. And you completely miss that in a tweet where you can only write 140 characters.
Right. And so then in last night's episode, he took on the ridiculousness of trying to convey something a little more sophisticated and nuanced in a tweet in 140 characters. So he really took on how the media latches onto these trends and then just goes haywire over them. And it was just a brilliant, almost Jonathan Swiftian response to this crazy story.
It was fantastic. And a reminder that sometimes, I mean, news organizations will just pick the low-hanging fruit without any nuance, like you mentioned, and without any perspective, because it's just an easy story to pound. And you know, that's the nature, to some degree, of our 24-hour news cycle.
And why we have the Colbert Report. to put it all
exactly
in
and why we have press play.
Oh, thank you. Thank you very much, Michael Schneider. Great way to end the show. Trying to
Thanks,
curry
Madeline.
Favor. I love it.
Absolutely.
Okay. Michael Schneider, Los Angeles Bureau Chief for TV Guide and co-host of KCRW's The Spinoff, and that's a podcast. You can download it for free at KCRW or iTunes. Thanks, Michael.
Thanks, Madeline.
All right. Do you have an all-time favorite TV finale? You can share your favorites with us. Leave us a voicemail at 1-844-PRESS-PLAY or tweet at us at KCRW-PRESS-PLAY. Coming up, an English TV personality comes to Los Angeles and discovers the city's stray dog problem. Louis Theroux also discovers he's not famous here. That story coming up on Press Play after a news update with Eric Roy.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage and accessible via our smartphone app or online at kcrw.com.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. The sunny skies and laid-back lifestyle of Los Angeles have always been alluring for uptight, rain-soaked Brits. And in return, the Brits get to enjoy snarky missives from their expats about how ludicrous the Hollywood-infused lifestyle can be. Think Evelyn Waugh, Aldous Huxley, Christopher Isherwood. And in that vein, a BBC TV presenter named Louis Theroux has produced a series of offbeat documentaries about Southern California called L.A. Stories. The first is called City of Dogs, and it's about the epidemic of stray dogs in South L.A.
I was on patrol with Cornelius Austin, a building caretaker and pit bull enthusiast known to all as Dogman.
I said, another stray. We have strays all around here.
Stray dog?
Yes.
You just saw one?
Yes. See, another stray, see? So you just never know what you're going to get.
Louis Theroux is here now. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Well, before you worked on L.A. Stories, you did other documentaries about wacky Americans, porn stars, Fred Phelps in the Westboro Baptist Church, UFO abductees. And here you are in L.A. So how are we to take that?
Well, I have a divided loyalty. So I am British by upbringing, but American on my father's side.
Your father's so, Paul Theroux, the famous
yes,
travel
he is.
Writer.
Mm-hmm. Yes, he is. So although I see that there are elements in my shows that do kind of have fun with some of the more outlandish or extreme aspects of American culture, I also try and explore a very human sort of emotional side to life here. So I feel as though you should be very pleased that I'm here, is what I'm saying.
Really? Okay. So we'll take it as a compliment.
Yes.
Why did you focus on South LA and its stray dog problem for your first documentary?
Okay, so this was a case where I thought, you know, LA is well known for its pampered dogs. So that was the initial impulse. And we all know about the Beverly Hills Chihuahuas and so forth. And I thought, well, that's kind of funny, and people will tune in for that in Britain. To some extent, yes, I'm aware there are prejudices British people have, and I keep those in mind. But at the same time, when we started digging, the more interesting story emerged, which was that there's these vast numbers of stray dogs roaming around in the low-income areas, especially in South LA. And so we became... I just decided to plunge into that. That felt a much more... Well, it felt like a richer story, and also we sort of straddled the stray dogs and then the journey they go on, almost like a kind of My Fair Lady journey, where polite society attempts to bring these stray dogs, many of them pit bulls, into their homes and rehabilitate them with mixed results.
So where is Casper?
He is no longer with us in the world, rather, we should say.
He's dead.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. I don't think he even knew what he was doing or how intensely hard he was biting her. But he did.
Okay, so, but why focus on the dogs rather than the people? There are lots of compelling human stories in South LA.
There are, and I've done stories about, for want of a better term, the hood or high crime areas and looked at people in gangs. And this felt like a different way of doing things, and that by looking at dogs, it could be a kind of fresh way of doing that.
Yeah, yeah. So what's the reaction in Britain? I mean, do they expect when they turn on the telly to see a documentary about dogs in LA when they want to hear an LA story?
I think people in Britain are pathological animal lovers. I mean, if I won't be thanked
especially
for saying this,
especially dogs.
But
especially
dogs. They go slightly overboard. So we made a show about another show about people in hospital with terminal illness or life-threatening conditions as part of this LA Stories run, and we see people dying in the show.
Hi, Langston. We've come from London, England. We're making a TV program here in the hospital, and so we've been filming your family a little bit and filming with you a little bit too. So we're hoping you're going to wake up and we can tell you a little bit more about what we're doing.
But when we showed the channel, that one and the dogs one, it was the dogs one they seemed to be worried about people getting upset by. So if anything, people in Britain have been very upset and depressed to see the condition of dogs in LA. But I would also say that it is quite extraordinary when you go to South LA, how, you know, in a big wealthy city, how many stray dogs there are. And the fact that thousands are being euthanized every year is amazing.
We've been very open about the fact that animals do get euthanized here fairly regularly in quite high numbers.
We never do more than like 10 or 12 in one day. Basically, the dog is standing there looking like this, and all of a sudden it just kind of goes like that.
So what was it like for you as a British guy walking around South LA? What kind of reaction did you get?
You know, I think sometimes I get what they call a ghetto pass because I'm so unthreatening. I'm the least likely guy in the room to try to step to you or start any static. So I think people are more bemused. But I also think in general, in high crime areas, that middle class people or people not from those areas have an exaggerated sense of the danger involved, and that as long as you're not about to set up shop on their corner and start dealing, they don't have a huge problem with you being there.
Right, except for one guy who is not very welcoming.
Okay, well, he was stressed out because his dog was being taken away. It was one of the most neglected dogs I'd seen. He was living in a house filled with feces and dirt. He was, I think, mentally ill, basically.
Marquise?
What?
Can we talk to you?
Talk to me? Take your ass back to London.
And he obviously didn't like me as well.
Right. Gotcha. Well, I'm wondering, though, because you are, your previous documentaries were funny, I mean, slightly snarky. Did you have a problem here with kind of straddling that line? Like, I felt that way watching the dog thing. Like, I felt like you wanted to be funny, but then this is a serious topic and there's a lot of pain in what you were uncovering. And so you couldn't be snarky, and yet you have that kind of British reserve and sense of humor.
I genuinely wasn't thinking, oh, I'd like to be funny, but I better not be. You know, in general, I don't try to be funny, but sometimes funny things happen, or sometimes just being in a situation is funny. Like, there's a scene in the dogs film where we visit a guy who trains dogs to be aggressive, and he talks about dogs as being like guns, but they're better than guns because you could get arrested for having a gun, but you can drive around with your dog, and then when you see a dangerous situation, the dog attacks. And then I had pads put on me, and I got attacked by the dog deliberately, called Prowler.
You scared?
Yeah, I think I am a bit
scared. No, don't be this. You're not going to feel him.
He's already picked me out.
And it was quite funny. I mean, it was just a sort of funny thing.
Stellan!
Okay, I think that's enough.
Bro, let loose!
Well, you worked with Michael Moore, right, on his TV Nation show that was back in the 1990s. But you're kind of the polar opposite of his style, wouldn't you say? He's got a very in-your-face style.
I think in certain ways I am, because he's sort of the biggest person in any scene that he films very often. Like, he's there to confront or push an agenda, and I don't mean that as a criticism. That, you know, that polemical style is valid and works wonderfully. It doesn't suit me or my personality, so I tend to be kind of smaller in the scenes. But having said that, I work with him and I learned so much from him. And what we do have in common is a sort of a certain, I don't know, like a, he showed me that you film a long time and you spend enough time with people and you usually create an interesting scene.
Yeah. And so do you think because you're more reserved and less in your face that people will open up to you more?
I think they do. And I don't know that Michael's agenda is always to get people to open up.
Yeah.
But I think that's what
run
I'm
away
usually
is
trying.
More like it.
Probably. But I do try and get people to open up. And I think by, you know, it's about building rapport and spending time and letting the person understand that you're genuinely interested in what they have to say.
Yeah, there are a lot of crying scenes in the dog one.
There are quite a few crying scenes. I don't like to have too many crying scenes back to back. But it's hard. Like people, they're very attached to their dogs. And when you're seeing your dog in distress or being put down, it's an emotional subject.
Yeah, that guy Greg.
Greg, retired fireman.
When you thought about her being sad and her being given up by her old family, that upset you, didn't it?
Sure, you know, we all have.
I like it when people turn the tables on me. He addresses the camera and goes,
this
guy, he's trying to get deep into my psyche, something like that.
Yeah.
And it's a kind of a funny thing where he's got my number.
There's abandonment issues.
So that's what you're thinking about. When you think about her being left, you're thinking about yourself.
I don't know. I have things lacking in my life that I need. And this dog fulfills that for me.
And so do you have a different perception now of Los Angeles than you did when you set out?
Well, I've had two different experiences of LA. One is living here as a man with a wife and two kids, and trying to experience the city as a sort of normal person, as it were. And then the other is as a journalist, experiencing the extremes of life. But I would say as both people, I've got a different understanding of what the city is.
And what is it? What are the two different understandings?
It's a city that works really well for some people and doesn't work for others. You know, it's a city that affords the best of life, you know, for many people, and especially in a private sphere where you can have an amazing house with a pool and you can just lead a sort of glamour-filled existence and have a nice car and get to work quickly. But that if you fall between the cracks, that life is much more difficult.
And so how is it personally for you?
It's been interesting. You know, on a personal basis, I know this is going to sound kind of trivial, but I'm fairly well known in Britain. So I've had a little adjustment to being an anonymous person and going to Hollywood parties, not that many, but a couple, and having this feeling of talking to a Hollywood actor and he says, and what do you do? And I say, I make documentaries for the BBC, and their eyes glaze over. And it's that feeling of I'm aware that I don't count for very much in the hierarchy of prestige in Los Angeles,
and
which is not a great feeling.
It's not. You really want to be famous here?
No, it's not that I want to be famous. I just want to feel like I'm interesting. I don't want to be invisible. You know, just socially. I don't want to be recognized at the supermarket, but I'd like to hold my own in a conversation.
And you don't think you can here? Because why? I mean, you're obviously a well-spoken, intelligent person with lots to say.
Well, I think so. Maybe we could put the word out.
So are you going to stay here for good, or are you going to go back?
No, I'd like to stay in L.A. a bit longer. You know, I think it's the city that British people, they love to hate, but they also love to love. And I guess I'm somewhere between the two. And I'd love to stay longer and explore more. I mean, I know I'll be continuing to come back. I'm working on a project about Scientology at the moment, and we're filming that, it's a feature documentary. So we'll be doing that over the next year or so. I'll come back for that and other stories. But I think in August, we're probably going to head back to London for personal reasons to do with... I'm going to blame my wife for that. I'm going to drop her in it because she misses her friends and family a lot, and she's a little worried about the kids not sort of missing their friends a bit.
Mm-hmm. And becoming Americans?
I'm okay with it. I'm an American, you know, not a very American American. I quite like the idea of having two little kids who say, gee, Dad, you know, what is your problem? You know, I'd enjoy that, I think.
Really?
Yeah, I think I would for a while. Do you think that would get old?
I think so, yes. All right. Louis Theroux, thanks so much for speaking with me today. And by the way, it's Los Angeles, not Los Angeles.
Oh, yes. Sorry about
that. Say that right. You can live here. All right. You can check out his documentaries, LA Stories, where? On YouTube.
Yes, I guess so, yeah.
Okay. Someone else who's a lover of Los Angeles is Warren Olney.
Well, I think
now.
We all love it as much as we hate it, you know. I think he's become an Angelino in that respect,
exactly.
Whether you can pronounce it right or not.
Well, what's up on the show?
Well, we're going to do kind of a backgrounder on Turkey, which the Obama administration had really looked to be a sort of an emissary of sorts or representative. I don't know exactly what term ought to be used. In the Middle East, and when the Prime Minister Erdogan took office, he was a big reformer. Well, now he's not a reformer at all. In fact, he's abused protesters. He's shut down Twitter and Facebook. There are apparently widely circulated recordings of him talking to his son about how they're going to move corrupt money around.
Mm.
And yet, over the weekend, his party won elections big time, so he's going to be around for a while, and there's no opposition on the horizon.
Okay, look forward to that interesting discussion at 1 o'clock, To the Point with Warren Olney. Thank
I'll be
you.
There.
All right. And coming up on this program, a new bill here in California would make companies liable if their temp workers are exploited on the job. That's next on Press Play.
This podcast is produced by KCRW, a nonprofit public radio station based in Los Angeles. We rely on listeners like you. Support the podcasts you love by becoming a member. Go to kcrw.com/join.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Temporary workers have long been near the bottom of the employment totem pole in places like warehouses, farms, hotels. Temps can face more wage violations and more injuries than permanent employees, and they have few protections when things go wrong. Well, now a new California bill tries to change that. If it passes, California would become one of the first states to make companies legally responsible for the pay and safety of their temps. Michael Graybell is a reporter for ProPublica, where he covers economics and labor. Welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
Well, tell us about the industries that employ temp workers in California. Where are they, and in which areas do they operate?
So a large portion of the temp workers in California work for warehouses, particularly in the Inland Empire. It's an area that's grown greatly in the distribution business, and that seems to be a place. There's also been an increase in hotels and in food processing plants and using temps.
So places like Amazon, those warehouses in the Inland Empire?
Exactly. Amazon, the Walmart warehouse, Mattel, many of the brand name companies.
And what are some of the problems that these workers face when they're working in these big warehouses or hotels?
A couple things. One is safety. A lot of times workers are sent on their very first day to work in a very hot environment that they're not used to. They're sent to go work on machines that they're not familiar with and given very little training. The other thing we see is because the pay is so low and there's so many different employers involved, there's often workers often complain about not being paid for all the hours they've worked. And then when they complain, no one knows who's responsible. They point fingers back and forth saying it's this contractor or this temp agency. No, it was that temp agency. And ultimately, the person that they're moving products for doesn't get held responsible.
So a lot of these workers they're not hired directly by the companies. They're hired through intermediaries, temp companies?
Yes, and often through many different layers. They might be moving products for Walmart, but it's at a warehouse run by a third-party contractor who then hires a temp agency.
Okay, and that's always been the argument on the part of these companies, saying, well, we didn't hire them, they're not our workers, so we're not responsible, right?
Right, exactly.
Okay, so tell us, there was this housekeeper from the DoubleTree Hotel who testified at a hearing on this issue last month. Tell us about her story.
So she was working as a temporary housekeeper actually for 2 years through a temp agency. And that's something we see a lot where people are kind of considered temps, but maybe on the job for 6 to 8 years through a temp agency. This housekeeper, Gladys Hernandez, worked at the DoubleTree Hotel in Santa Monica, and she told the committee that her quota was so demanding, the quota of rooms she had to clean every day was so demanding that she sometimes had to go downstairs, clock out, and then go back upstairs to finish the rooms off the clock, unpaid. And when she and some other coworkers finally mustered up the energy to go complain to DoubleTree management, she was told the next day by the temp agency not to come back.
So she was fired because she complained.
Yeah, one can call it fired, but because of the ambiguities with the temping business, companies can kind of get away with it. The job, you know, ran out all of a sudden. They said they don't need that person, an extra person anymore. And it's very hard to prove that retaliation occurred.
So under this law, what would happen to Gladys Hernandez? If this were, in fact, a law, how would her case end up differently?
Right now, she or the state could prove that there was a wage violation at her temp agency, but very unlikely against the franchise owner who runs the hotel. What she would have to do is she would have to go to court after several years and prove through the discovery process that they actually controlled the workplace. Under this law, it would create this presumption that the hotel owner is actually in charge and they could be fined automatically if a violation was found.
I'm wondering, does this affect agricultural workers, and would that then change the way farms maybe need to check for immigration status?
The law doesn't specifically address immigration status, but it does apply from my understanding, it would apply to growers. Right now, what you have is the grower, a grower has a large farm, and they essentially will outsource this to a farm labor contractor who controls the group of workers in a specific part of the farm. And that farm owner is not responsible generally for what happens on the farm, even if the workers are abused. Under the law, as it's proposed, that farm owner would be held responsible for hiring a bad farm labor contractor who abuses his workers. And so they would have to supervise them more closely, have to do better or more background checking of the farm labor contractors to make sure they are good employers so that they don't essentially just swap them out with another bad contractor if something happens.
So this seems like a pretty big change. Is it going to pass? What are its chances?
It's up in the air. The political leanings in California seem to be in the favor of the bill, I would assume. 2 years ago, the same advocates succeeded in getting a bill passed in related to warehouse temp workers, though that was much narrower in scope. This is obviously a bigger change, but it has happened in Illinois. Illinois currently has a bill like this with temp agencies where the company is ultimately responsible when workers aren't paid their wages.
So what's the next step in this? It's been introduced, and when will it come up for a vote?
Sometime down the line. They have to schedule it. Nothing has been scheduled yet.
Michael Graybell is a reporter for ProPublica, where he covers economics and labor. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me on.
Right, time to check the mail with Jolie Myers. Hi there.
Hi, Madeline. So we talked about series finales earlier
in the
show. So How I Met Your Mother, of course, had the series finale last night. Not a lot of fans of the ending. I had an idea. How about a series How I Met Your Father? And that way we can explore the whole other side of the coin for 9 years before we find out what happens. I'm sure I'm not the first person who thought of that. But we asked you both for your favorite series finales and your least favorite series finales. There are some legendarily awful series finales out there. I would like to nominate Seinfeld in that category.
If I call Jill from prison, you think that would make up for the other ones?
Sure.
Because you only get one call. The prison call is like the king of calls.
I think that would be a very nice gesture.
And that's the Seinfeld crew doing their shtick
from prison. I remember people hating that. It was not good.
You know,
double plus not good.
Double plus not good. But what's funny is I went back and watched the whole clip to get that cut of tape for this segment. And it was funny.
Mm-hmm.
I laughed out loud and I was like, you know what? That actually is sort of funny.
I don't think you can ever really win with a finale. I really don't.
I am sort of a firm believer of that. However, there are a lot of people who wrote in and said and told us their favorite series finales. There was a lot of people who voted for this show.
I am not in danger, Skyler. I am the danger. A guy opens his door and gets shot and you think that of me? No, I am the one who knocks.
That's funny. That's on my business card. I am the one who knocks. No, this is from Breaking Bad, of course. And a lot of people liked the finale, but it was controversial. Some people said it was a stinker. So there's other favorite finales. Lots of votes for 6 Feet Under. MASH got a ton of votes. So that's still stuck in people's minds. Maybe they're watching it on Nick at Night now. Sex in the City. We even got a vote for Star Trek, The Next Generation. I don't know. Were you a big Trekkie?
No, Matt? No, not a big Trekkie.
You know, I can't weigh in on that one either. I have never seen a show, though. I do like the memes that star Jean-Luc Picard. I think that those are some good memes.
I really like the Sopranos finale.
The Fade to Black finale.
I really loved it.
Very controversial choice. Nate Amick wrote us on Facebook, and he wanted to nominate Dancing with the Stars for Best Series Finale. And you may be saying, well, that show is still on TV, Jolie. And that's actually Nate's point. He can't wait for it to end. He says, I can't stand that garbage and I can't wait for it to end. That will be my favorite series finale ever. Thanks, Nate.
All right. I think that's your finale for now, right?
I think so.
We're all done. And it's our finale as well. There will be a premiere coming up in a few minutes of, well, premiere for the day of Warren Olney and To The Point. I'm Madeline Brand. And for all of us here at Press Play, I'll see you tomorrow.